commence with day two of our poker. Let me firstly start by apologizing for being late. I had an incident on the road. I was kept there for about 30 minutes. So I'm really very sorry to be late. I hope my apology is accepted. Let's proceed. I see the apology has been accepted. Everybody is nodding in the house. members are nodding. Accepted. Okay, the apologies, once again, we've got the apology of the minister. As we said yesterday, the minister will be available yesterday and today. I don't know about members. Okay. Will not be able to join us. We don't know about the rest of the other colleagues. I think today, this morning, we'll have to accelerate the pace now because we have to be out of this place by 12. As I said, we are on day two of our program. I must bring to the attention of the meeting that I got a letter yesterday, last night, from the minister, Minister Mokonyane, about the issues we're discussing on the signing of the agreement. So when Sandparks come, I think that will be an opportunity to get feedback from Sandpark, as well as to read out that letter for members' attention. For now, let's proceed with Dr. Low from Ben Animal Trading, who's going to be talking to us about the ethics of trophy hunting in private nature reserves adjacent to the Kruger National Park. Okay, Dr. Low. I'm told the screens are not working. They will need about 30 minutes for them to be rebooted. But in the meantime, let's proceed. I hope members have got a copy of Professor Law's presentation. It's the title there, The Ethics of Hunting in Private Nature Reserves Adjacent to the KNP. It's a 9-page submission. I hope it's going to do it. You'll do it in the allocated time of 30 minutes. Okay, over to Dr. Low.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you. Honourable Chair, honourable members, morning, everybody. I'm going to be speaking on the ethics of hunting in private nature reserves adjacent to the Kruger National Park, but also a little bit on the ethics of hunting in general. As an introduction, the Kruger National Park is used internationally as an example of one of the most important national parks in the world. It is obviously important for conservation purposes, but it is also extremely important for purposes of scientific research. It goes without saying that the animals in such a splendid national institution belong to the people of South Africa. It also goes without saying that hunting those animals for sport would be so morally offensive that no right-thinking person would even propose a debate on hunting the animals of the Kruger National Park. A number of years ago, the KNP entered into an agreement with farmers adjacent to the park to drop the fences. This had the effect of expanding the area of the park and allowing the animals some free movement. The ultimate beneficiaries of the dropping of the fences should be the animals of the park. In exchange, the owners of the areas adjacent to the park obtained the singular benefit of hosting Kruger animals on their private properties for their own private viewing enjoyment. Unfortunately, the benefit to the animals that was generated by the dropping of the fences is now a moral and ethical controversy, because the owners of the properties to which the animals migrate have found a way to justify killing the animals for their own pleasure and profit. The rules of law under which they operate are founded on the concept of land ownership, bringing with it ownership of wild animals on the surface of the land, just as it brought ownership of the minerals below the surface. But modern thinking has developed. It has, for example, been recognized that minerals are a national resource that ought not to belong to the surface owner to exploit, but should vest in the state. The old law that the owner of the surface of land can do with wild animals found upon it whatever he or she wishes, including killing them for his or own pleasure and profit, must be recognized and reconsidered. This presentation is not about statistics, the number of animals, or ecological concerns. It focuses solely on the morality and ethics of private reserves adjacent to the Kruger National Park, where South Africa's precious heritage is killed. We are also not concerned with what hunters themselves believe would be right and wrong in given circumstances. Hunters have adopted for their own use the term ethical, and they distinguish between ethical hunters and unethical hunters, damning the second category to those who participate in can hunting. Our approach is completely different. We do not care what hunters themselves think may be good or bad hunting practices. We take issue on a moral and ethical basis with hunting as a phenomenon. The ultimate aim of this presentation is to make the moral argument against hunting in general and against hunting in the areas where the fences have been dropped, adjacent to the Kruger National Park in particular. Whilst hunting is per definition in our book immoral, the hunting by private individuals of animals who form part of the national treasure is particularly immoral. An industry that is based on immoral and unethical practices can never form the basis of any job creation, and hunting is such an industry. Morality, it is generally accepted, has to do with the distinction between good and bad. Morality operates on the individual level, and every individual, being a moral being, is compelled to make moral decisions throughout his or her life. Morality as a concept makes it possible to express a view about the conduct of another person and labeling such conduct moral or immoral. Morality has to do with the individual choices that people make, with what is good or bad, and not with what is legal and illegal. Ethics is society's conception of what is generally right and wrong, elevating the particular norm into a general norm. Ethics concerns the general consensus of society on what is right and wrong in a specific context. Ethics concerns the sum view of society in general, and not the views of a subclass of society. Just as society does not take notice of the ethics of, for example, those who participate in state capture, apparently they open each meeting to discuss bribes with a prayer, society also will not and should not take note of the ethics made up by such subsets, such as hunters. The making of a set of rules by people who are in agreement and who make the rules for themselves, in this case trophy hunters, has nothing to do with ethics. The concept of ethical conduct has been usurped by the hunters who distinguish between ethical and unethical hunting, whilst all they really do is to describe what is acceptable and unacceptable to them as hunters. It is immaterial whether some hunters call themselves ethical hunters and condemn the practices of other hunters. We must establish whether hunting as a sport for the purpose of gathering trophies to hang on walls is ethical or not, and then especially in the areas adjacent to the Kruger National Park where the fences have been dropped. The moral case for sport hunting explains that it is not immoral to hunt for sport because Sentient animals are being slaughtered for food on a daily basis around the globe, and it can hardly be said that this industrial-scale slaughtering is immoral. It's true that millions of animals are killed in factories around the globe every day. Banned animal trading despises and opposes the factory farming of animals, but that is not what is presently at issue. As far as society is concerned, there is a major difference between factory farming and sport hunting on the moral plane. Society, and not banned animal trading, I need to make it clear, justifies factory farming as a necessary evil. Most right-thinking people do not enjoy and relish in the practices of factory farming, but are repulsed by these practices. Hunting for sport is never necessary. The sport hunter enjoys the act of killing. Society places the trophy hunter in a different category than the mother who buys chicken drumsticks at the supermarket to feed her family. Society judges the person who kills for his or her own pleasure, for personal profit, harshly, and it also judges such individuals as perverse. Sport hunting is always morally reprehensible, and justifying animal killings for the sake of entertainment is untenable. And bonding with nature through lethal means is an indefensible form of recreation and leisure. Trophy hunters use religion as another major defense of their killing of animals for profit and pleasure. They believe that hunting is simply performing God's will. God would not have made, they say, it possible for human beings to develop all the methods for hunting and killing animals if God was not in favor of hunting. What a perverse argument. People might have needed to hunt in pre-industrial times for purposes of survival, but those days have gone. To justify hunting on the basis of an inborn impulse is as unjustifiable as using child brides. Morality evolves. Society today cannot and should not decide what is morally right and wrong on the basis of ancient practices. Killing animals is certainly not a sport. Sport hunting comes down to a human being armed with some device that gives him or her the ability to kill an animal. These devices or weapons transform a somewhat pathetic human, when compared to majestic animals, into a killer. There is no equality of arms in trophy hunting. The arms carried by the human far outweigh the defense mechanisms of animals. Society understands the concept of sport as a celebration of the human form. Sport concerns the testing of the human body against different yardsticks, such as, for example, running a race over a distance where one athlete competes against another athlete. Sport is always played on a level playing field and with equality of arms. It is this aspect that is completely missing when animals are killed for pleasure and profit. Hunting is immoral because it places the human being in a position of power over an unequal and powerless animal. It is based on a Stone Age concept of power, and that power always triumphs. If you have power over something or someone, your will is the law and you are right. If you own something, you can do with it, because animals are seen as goods and commodities, as you wish. This concept of ownership is fast becoming outdated because of the massive distortions that it creates in society. The days of slavery, apartheid, and witch hunts are over. Society has evolved beyond that kind of thinking. Owners cannot destroy their possessions as they see fit. Ownership carries responsibilities, and these include the obligation to protect, not to destroy, these so-called possessions. The killing of animals for sport infringes upon their rights as sentient beings. They feel pain, they become tense and anxious, they experience separation from members of their group, and the list goes on. Human beings are, in the final analysis, simply animals with no more claims to sensory awareness, fear, and anxiety than any other animal. The only difference is that the human animal can make decisions about other animals. And it is in this context that the question applies whether killing animals for pleasure and profit is morally good or bad, and it should be elevated into a system of ethics that must become law. It has been said above that the dropping of the fences is a truly remarkable act that has added vast areas to the habitat in which the Kruger animals can move around more freely. We have also said that killing these animals is not only counterproductive, but is morally reprehensible, simply because these animals are a national treasure, and no one should have the right to kill a national treasure for his and or her own bloodlust and profit. The argument goes further than this. We are in South Africa at present at a crossroads in our thinking about private ownership. In the past, those who had the physical might and power to subject others to their will took what they wanted from the land as they saw fit and with no compunction as to the wishes of those who previously lived on or adjacent to the land. South African national resources landed in the hands of a limited representative sample of our society, who upheld the colonialist ethos that sport hunting is the sacred and exclusive right of the wealthy and the elite, and that the animals of the plains and forests belong to them, to do with as they please. Affording a few privileged, mostly white, men and women to hunt animals that form part of the national heritage for the joy of killing and to display status and power is particularly pernicious. These wrongs must be righted. And this line must be pulled through to the animals that are now on private reserves adjacent to the Kruger National Park. These private reserve owners might perhaps, in terms of ancient common law rules, have the right to kill whatever wild animal is on their land, but this does not translate into moral conduct in the 21st century. The commendable act displayed by the authorities, and in this case Sam Parks, which has the mandate to protect the biodiversity of the Kruger National Park, to drop the fences, was facilitated by the generosity of the owners of the surrounding private reserves to host the Kruger animals. All of these commendable acts are negated when the private reserve owner is no longer the altruistic host, but the killer or facilitator of killings of animals who are in South African heritage. This moral argument does not depend on statistics. It does not matter how many members of which species are shot and killed on the private reserves around the Kruger National Park. The killing of one animal for profit and pleasure, such as Skye, who was killed, we believe, illegally in the Umbabat last year, is enough to raise the moral indignation of all right-thinking members of society, and trophy hunters are well aware of this. It is fundamentally wrong to kill animals who form part of our national heritage and who, as a matter of fact and law, belong to all of us for pleasure and profit and to satisfy some primitive form of bloodlust. Hunting or killing for pleasure and profit always happens under the guise of conservation and of habitat protection. Hunters believe that conservation and habitat protection is only possible when wild animals are killed for pleasure and profit, and hunters also believe that they are the best environmentalists, the selfless heroes of conservation. What hunters have successfully done is to turn conservation, which aims to protect and save animals, into big business. Conservation has become an investment opportunity and is no longer an end in itself. Hunters are not natural predators, and they kill the strongest, largest, and often rarest members of any animal community for trophies. How does this contribute to conservation? In fact, it puts entire families at risk and threatens the overall population of the species, as has been witnessed in the case of Skye mentioned above, the wrong lion who was killed in the Umbabat last year. On the topic of Skye, who is believed to have been lured out of the protected Kruger National Park onto a privately owned nature reserve, how did this specific killing contribute to conservation and habitat protection? In summary, the dropping of the fences is perhaps one of the most far-sighted acts of the management of the ecology. It adds vast areas to the habitat of the animals of the Kruger National Park and allows the movement. However, the real problem lies in the fact that these areas are privately owned and the animals are exploited for the exclusive benefit of a wealthy and elitist section of our population. They treat the animals as their own and kill them as if they are private property and not the precious heritage of all South Africans. Wild animals do not know boundaries created by humans. Those who have the means to kill animals and call it conservation use the fact that animals cannot distinguish invisible human boundaries to their benefit and privatize South Africa's national heritage for personal profit and pleasure. The wealthy human occupants of most of the private nature reserves fail to understand that the fences were dropped for ecological reasons. The private nature reserves, by signing the agreement with the KNP to create ecological unity, have agreed to give the animals, South Africa's natural heritage, a right to move freely from the Kruger Park through the private nature reserves. The animals are still Kruger animals, even when they cross the imaginary boundaries created by the private reserves. It is illegal to hunt animals in the Kruger National Park. Yet a few centimeters in the wrong direction of free movement makes it legal to kill them. The fences were not dropped to provide windfalls for private reserve owners to exploit wild animals for profit and pleasure. The killing of the animals in the private areas adds another layer to the murky and moral problems of sport hunting. The long-term damage caused by the trophy hunting activities outweighs any possible perceived short-term gain, and the negative evolutionary effects of trophy hunting on wild populations will deplete these populations and will thus threaten the tourism industry. Moreover, trophy hunting is incompatible with South Africa's current attempts to enhance its international image as a destination for ecotourism. Ecotourism and trophy hunting are mutually exclusive. Ecotourists do not want to go to places where wildlife is killed. Trophy hunting will give and has given South Africa a bad name as an ecotourist destination and is thus likely to reduce earnings from ecotourism. Brand South Africa has already suffered irreparable damage because of the captive breeding of big cats for their bones. We choose to believe that the subsistence hunting of animals for food and clothing thousands of years ago did not turn men into savages with no moral compass. Our times have changed. Traditions have become twisted, and hunting is now mostly the unregulated killing of South Africa's precious heritage, practiced in this country by an exclusive racial group that had the financial means to kill for profit and pleasure. Trophies, the heads, tusks, horns, and other body parts of magnificent wild animals are what we will leave behind for the next generation. I conclude with the words of Matthew Scully, author of Dominion. The care of animals brings with it often complicated problems of economics, ecology, and science. But above all, it confronts us with the question of conscience. Most of us seem to have lost all sense of restraint towards animals, an understanding of natural boundaries, a respect for them as beings with needs and wants, and a place and a purpose of their own. We assume that our interests always come first, and if it's profitable or expedient, that's all we need to know. We assume that we are everything and they are nothing. Animals are more than ever a test of our character, of mankind's capacity for empathy, and for decent, honorable conduct and faithful stewardship. We are called to treat them with kindness, not because they have rights of power or some claim to equality, but in a sense because they don't, because they all stand unequal and powerless before us. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Dr. Lowe. Let's move to the next presentation by Sarah from Komakalinen, or Sarah and Komakalinen from Kalinen and Associates Incorporated. So they will talk to us about the fundamental problems of the regulation of trophy hunting in the GLTCA and the benefit sharing with local communities and suggestions for law reform. Okay? The initial intention was to probe the benefit sharing by the community there that arises from the dropping of the fences. But I'm worried that we are getting more into hunting, which was not the original intention of this two-day inquiry. It probably has to do with the items identified and the stakeholders identified by our content advisor. But I must just caution us that this inquiry is not about trophy hunting per se. We did say in our statement the last time that we need to discuss the hunting protocols in the Greater Kruger National Park, because in the national park itself, hunting is prohibited, but in the adjacent private reserve, it is allowed. And these animals are, of course, roaming freely. So at what point do you say this is in the Kruger? At what point do you say, because there are no fences? So we said that has to be discussed, but for today the focus was on, I think probably on this, in this instance, dog missed the script, because the focus was supposed to be more on how are these benefits supposed to be shared. But it's fine, we are here now, let's just proceed with the next presentation, because it also talks to trophy hunting as well. And allow our guests to give us a presentation. I saw there's something here, a letter, so I don't know whether there is a presentation. Okay, members, do you have a presentation? There's this presentation. The system is still rebooting and it's no longer going to take 30 minutes. It's going to take a while, so we don't know how long the system is going to reboot, so that everybody else can be able to follow the presentations. But let me take this opportunity and hand over to you. I guess you also have 30 minutes to take us through it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, everyone. So just to outline our presentation, we want to first consider the fundamental issue of the legal status of wild animals in the areas open to the Kruger National Park, and I'm going to refer to that whole system as the open system, as it is referred to in the cooperative agreement. We also want to consider issues of transparency and accountability that we and our clients have encountered in the regulation of hunting and benefit sharing in the open system. And then finally, we're going to make some recommendations for legal reform. As you probably know, the common law regards animals as things. Judge Cameron, in a fairly recent Supreme Court of Appeal decision, put it very succinctly. He said, like slaves under Roman law, they are the objects of the law without being its subjects. Cormac's going to talk in the second half of our presentation more about that fundamental issue. Apart from being regarded as things in our common law, free-ranging wild animals that are not under the control of any person are regarded by our common law as being res nullius, which means they are not owned by any person. The effect of this is that an animal that escapes from a protected area becomes res nullius and then is able to be hunted or used or captured in any way by any person. when game farming became more popular, this became a problem. And in response to that, the Game Theft Act was enacted in 1991, which modified the common law somewhat. However, there's some debate about whether the Game Theft Act applies to animals, would apply to animals in the open system that have moved out of the Kruger Park areas into the private areas, because the Game Theft Act narrowly defines game animals to be those which are kept for commercial and hunting purposes. So the consensus seems to be that the Game Theft Act wouldn't apply to those animals, and the effect then is that those animals will become res nullius once they pass out of the Kruger Park areas into the privately owned areas. So why is this a problem? The urban system, as I have said,
come again?
Res nullius.
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. Does this not apply to the fences when the animal jumps the fence?
Yes. Mr. Chair, I apologize. I'm hard of hearing. That's just why I'm struggling to hear you, but Cormac will respond.
Mr. Chair, was your question about does res nullius apply where animals jump the fence? So the concept applies to animals that are not enclosed. So in circumstances where you have a game-proof fence around an area, the landowner can own the game within that area. Now, there's a dispute about exactly what game includes. It's not all animals, but it's a lot of wildlife. But once you have an open area, in other words, the game or not enclosed with the game proof fence, then the common law situation applies that they are unowned and res nullius.
Okay, so why is this a problem? As I said, the open system comprises both a national park and privately owned areas. Historically and in general, national parks are designated because they are areas of national, even international, biodiversity importance. In terms of both the Biodiversity Act and the Protected Areas Act, the state is not the owner of these areas, but the trustee, the beneficiary being the people of South Africa. We argue that the res nullius concept is archaic and inconsistent with the constitutional and environmental law framework at present. And secondly, we argue that because the national park is part of the open
system. Can I ask you to speak closer to the mic?
I apologize. Secondly, we argue that because the national park is part of the open system must be regulated and governed in a way that is entirely transparent and accountable to the people of South Africa. That this is not the case is illustrated by some of the problems that we and our clients have encountered and which I'm going to explain next. A good illustration of the weak governance in respect of the open system is the Umbabat lion hunt, which took place in 2018. Firstly, the permitting authorities made the decision to allow the offtake of a lion without the support of the Kruger National Park. The information that is required to be provided by the private stakeholders to the Kruger National Park to allow it to make that decision about the offtake was in some cases not complete or scientifically sound, and from correspondence from Sandparks that we have seen, this has been the case on many occasions. The provisions of the existing hunting protocol were basically ignored, and again we've seen correspondence that indicates that this was not an isolated incident, and there were no sanctions for the parties involved.
You have all heard yesterday that a new cooperative agreement was signed on the 5th of December 2018, and this creates the legal framework for trophy hunting and benefit sharing in the open system. You've also heard that the directions of Parliament were not followed in the signing of that agreement. Interested and affected parties were not invited to comment on any draft agreements. On behalf of our clients, we wrote letters to Sam Parks on the 29th of November 2018 and the 3rd of December 2018, warning it that the signing of the agreement on the 5th of December was contrary, was in direct contravention of a direction from Parliament, was contrary to the NEMA principles about transparent governance, and was potentially unfair administrative action. We have copies of the letters which we can provide. Sam Parks persisted in signing it, despite the threat of legal action from us if it did so. Why is it a problem that the new agreement has been signed? In our view, there are no effective improvements in the new agreement in the way that trophy hunting and benefit sharing are governed. In fact, the whole system is governed. Trophy hunting will continue to be governed by protocols, as is the case, I believe, with benefit sharing, adopted by the Joint Management Committee, which is established by the agreement. Compliance with any protocols adopted by the Joint Management Committee is not mandatory, and there are no penalties for not complying with the protocols. The Joint Management Committee itself has no legal personality. It's not clear whether it's a public body, and this has implications for the right of access to information from it. Importantly, stakeholders who are not members of the JNC have no right to attend meetings. They may do so by invitation only. The third issue that we've encountered is a culture of secrecy around from the conservation authorities around information pertaining to trophy hunting and benefit sharing. Typically, conservation authorities don't provide any information without a formal request for information in terms of the Promotion of Access to Information Act. In almost all cases, information, and in all cases relating to trophy hunting, information about the parties involved in trophy hunting or wildlife trading or benefit sharing is refused. Our submission is that personal information is not protected per se by PIA. It is protected only in very limited circumstances. But often, in fact, proper reasons for refusing the information are not given. So it's difficult to know what grounds the state is relying on. Because an internal appeal is only available to departments of state that are public bodies, often an internal appeal is not available to stakeholders in respect of information refused. This means that their only remedy is a high court application costing, as we know, many hundreds of thousands of rands typically. It's not financially feasible for NGOs and individuals, and it's a real barrier to access to information. So, in summary, animals in the Kruger National Park and the areas open to it are held in trust by the state for the benefit of the people of South Africa. The state has a clear duty to make information about the management of the open system accessible to the public as swiftly, inexpensively, and effortlessly as reasonably possible. Those words come from the Promotion of Access to Information Act. Our submission is that the current cooperative agreement will not ensure good governance of the open system, which includes trophy hunting and the regulation of benefit sharing. Our submission is also that amendments are needed to PIA to make it easier to challenge the decisions of public bodies that are not departments of state to refuse information. I'm going to hand over now to Cormac, who's going to consider some proposals for reform.
Thank you, Sarah. Honourable Chair, Honourable Members, ladies and gentlemen. I'm going to address the question of law reform, which by its nature is a long-term issue. Because I think it is the only way in which one can deal properly with the short-term issues that this committee has been wrestling with for some time. Now, legislation is typically passed to address a problem in society, what used to be called a mischief. But before you rush into legislation, it's very important to understand the nature of the problem, because if you misdiagnose the problem, you end up with the wrong solution. Now, this relates directly to this question of benefit sharing. Many of you may be familiar with the old story about a family who has a golden goose, and every day this goose lays a golden egg. And of course the family are very wealthy and do very well because they have a golden egg every day. But after a while they get greedy and they think there must be an enormous number of golden eggs inside this goose. So if we kill the goose and cut it open, we can get all our golden eggs now, immediately. And of course they kill the goose and there are no golden eggs inside the goose and they never get another golden egg. Now the reason I raise this story is because when we are talking about benefit sharing, and it's a very important issue, and I'm not trying to diminish it in any way. When one is talking about the division of the eggs, one must be very careful that one doesn't accidentally kill the goose in the process. And that's what I'm trying to address here. So unfortunately, I can't show you the slides on the screen, but what I'd like to start with is a quick reminder of the big picture. In other words, this is the context in which we are having these discussions. So at the moment that we are in the sixth period of mass extinction, species have not been dying and going extinct at this rate since the dinosaurs disappeared 65 million years ago. So we are talking about events happening on a scale that has never happened before in the history of humanity. We have exceeded the so-called planetary boundary for genetic diversity. In other words, we are in very, very dangerous territory, and there are danger of genetic collapses around the world because of the extinctions that have occurred. Just to give one example, global wildlife populations have fallen by approximately 58% since 1970, and vertebrates are heading for a two-thirds reduction by next year. Now, this is within my lifetime and the lifetime of most of the people in this room. So what we are talking about is a catastrophic collapse in wild species around the globe. And you'll see the planetary boundaries diagrams on the which I hope to show you. But in essence, what this is that scientists from the Stockholm Resilience Institute proposed quantitative planetary boundaries within which humanity can continue and thrive for generations. But if you cross these boundaries, the risk of generating large-scale, abrupt, or irreversible environmental change is very, very high. And if you look at them, the genetic diversity one, we are way, way beyond the boundary. In fact, it's far further beyond the boundary than even climate change. I should say this diagram is slightly out of date, so the climate change is probably in the orange rather than where it is now. But even the scientific evidence that we are in enormous trouble as far as the loss of wild species and habitats is concerned does not really convey the true meaning of what I'm talking about. Ladies and gentlemen, our species won the cosmic lottery. We have the extreme good fortune to have been born into the richest, most beautiful, most diverse community of life that we have been able to find in the entire universe. We are unbelievably privileged to have been born into that community of life, and we are destroying it at a terrifying rate. This community of life is the goose that lays all the golden eggs. Without it, humanity does not survive. We don't have clean air, clean water. We don't have food. And the reason for this is that we have, most of the societies have fallen into this mistaken way of thinking that originated in the 16th and 17th century in Europe during the so-called Age of Enlightenment. And this view is really that humans are the pinnacle of the evolutionary process, that we are the top dogs, we are superior to and separate from the world, the nature. And so we're entitled to monopolize natural resources and to outcompete other species. Now, The opposing worldview is that human beings are an integral and inseparable part of the community of life, without which we cannot exist. And so the health of the whole is paramount. Now, the point here is that both these points of view can't be true. It's like saying either the earth moves around the sun or the sun moves around the earth. Now, the belief that humanity is separate from and superior to nature and that we can flourish while nature is ruined around us is completely scientifically untenable. It's just a delusion. Unfortunately, I can't show you the pictures that I wanted to show to illustrate this point, but the one shows us the attitude that we are separate from and superior to nature, and that the world exists as resources for us to exploit, and the other gives one a sense of what it's like to be in the community of life. There's also a picture that I wanted to show you of the difference between a live sky, a live lion sky, and a dead one. One, do you see that lion as a member of the community of life, or as a resource, as an object, simply to be exploited for money? And this is a very, very fundamental shift that I'm talking about. If humanity does not make the shift, we will not survive. So that's the big picture. In other words, when we have these discussions about very specific examples of protecting and regulating wildlife, it's important to remember the global context and the fact that we're dealing with events which are significant on the scale of millions of years, not just 10 years or 5 years. But now coming down to the more specifics of the situation, why are the existing laws problematic? Well, first of all, they're based on the mistaken beliefs that the universe is centered on humans, the so-called anthropocentric idea, that humans are separate from and superior to nature. And in this country, unfortunately, we are familiar with what happens when one group of the community decides that they are separate from and superior to the rest of the community and that their interests are best served by exploiting their community. That is exact thinking which underlay apartheid. And now we are effectively living a kind of, we're applying the same thinking inadvertently to all the other non-human members of the community. And the problem is that the law is designed on the mistaken belief that we are better off by exploiting nature, which we define as indigenous biological resources in this case, than trying to coexist harmoniously within the community of life. And this leads directly to the idea that wild animals are defined as res nullius and are natural resources available to exploit for exploitation, which in most cases drives them towards extinction. Fortunately, there is a global shift happening. Around the world, courts in India, Colombia, and Pakistan have recognized rivers, glaciers, and forests as legal persons which entitled to the protection of the law in the same way as human beings are. In Ecuador, the Constitution recognizes the rights of nature. In New Zealand, legislation has been passed to recognize two rivers, a river and a mountain, a former national park, as legal persons. And a lot of this has been driven by the perspectives of the indigenous people around the world who have retained this integral understanding of humans as part of the community of life. But fortunately, it's also happening in South Africa. At the moment, it's really only evident in the Constitutional Court. And there you'll see, I've cited some of the statements of the Constitutional Court in the 2016 case of the National Society for the Protection Conservation Animal, NSPCA case. And what the High Court said, and I think it's worth just repeating that here, is as follows. Cameron J.A.'s minority judgment in the Openshaw case recognized that animals are worthy of protection, not only because of the reflection that this has on human values, but because animals are sentient beings that are capable of suffering and of experiencing pain. The High Court in South African Predator Breeders Association case championed this view. A unanimous full bench found that the canned hunting of lions is, quote, abhorrent and repulsive due to the animal suffering. On appeal, the Supreme Court of Appeal did not dispute this finding. In other words, although the original decision was set aside on appeal, it was on other grounds. It did not set aside this finding. The Constitutional Court carries on to say, the Supreme Court of Appeal in Lim Tong Tai case explained in the context of rhino poaching that, quote, constitutional values dictate a more caring attitude towards fellow humans, animals, and the environment in general. The court concluded further that this obligation was especially pertinent because of our history, obviously a history of exploitation, not caring. Therefore, the court said, the rationale behind protecting animal welfare has shifted from merely safeguarding the moral status of humans to placing intrinsic value on animals as individuals. The Lim Tong Tai case is also notable, said the Constitutional Court, because it relates animal welfare to the question of biodiversity. Animal welfare is connected with the constitutional right to have the environment protected through legislative and other means. This integrative approach correctly links the suffering of individual animals to conservation and illustrates the extent to which showing respect and concern for individual animals reinforces broader environmental protection. Animal welfare and animal conservation together reflect two intertwined values. So here you have the conservation, you have the Constitutional Court giving a very, very clear interpretation that you must understand the environmental right in Section 24 as being related to the intrinsic value of animals and encompassing both the well-being and welfare aspect as well as the conservation aspects. So then turning now to the question of what advantages new legislation would have. First of all, new legislation would facilitate the essential shift from exploitation to harmonious coexistence. The United Nations has a program, if you look at their website, on living in harmony with nature, and this records the shift which is happening around the world towards this, in this respect. So legislation can play a very important educative role in this regard. It would also align with the Constitutional Court's interpretation of Section 24 and the duty to take reasonable measures to protect the environment. Importantly, it would integrate ecological conservation and animal well-being. In other words, the Constitutional Court have pointed out this is an artificial distinction, but it runs right through the current legislation and needs to be changed. It would also resolve many of the problems caused by the outdated and problematic legal status of wild animals. All the issues that we have around the proper regulation of the animals in the APNR area relate to this legal status of animals and the fact that it is outdated and unhelpful, as you've heard from several speakers. So just to give you a very brief indication about what such an act might look like, I've suggested it could be called something like the Wildlife or Animal Freedom Act, but the title is not important. In essence, it would recognize the inherent value and rights of indigenous species and protect their freedom to live wild. And let's face it, they were Africans living on this continent before we were even thought of. It would recognize that indigenous animals and species have inherent rights to exist within an ecosystem capable of meeting their needs and the right to remain wild so that they can contribute to the integrity, health, and functioning of ecosystems. It's very important to understand these animals within the context of the ecosystems within which they have a specific they've been evolved to play specific roles. The Act would impose specific duties on human beings. So human beings and juristic persons like companies or in the state must not deprive wild animals of their liberty or life without adequate justification. For example, there may be instances where it's necessary to shoot animals for the sake of the ecosystem or in self-defense or something like that. And they must not treat animals in a cruel or abusive manner. That should not be controversial at all. There should also be specific duties on landowners and occupiers of land. Owners and occupiers of land must take reasonable measures to ensure that the environment is not degraded in a manner that is harmful to the indigenous species that inhabit it, and must not confine, kill, disturb, or harass wild animals without a good and sufficient reason. And what's good and sufficient would have to be determined by rules or processes. So this is about respecting the other inhabitants of this continent and this planet, not only for their benefit, but to ensure the health of the planet on which we all depend. So I would like to just conclude by bringing this I'm aware that I've been speaking at quite a high level and I've been speaking about long-term solutions. But as you, as honourable members are very well aware, the exercise you're currently engaged in, which is about scrutinising and overseeing executive action, complements the other most important function of this House, which is to pass legislation. And what we need in the long term is legislation here. So if we come down to the question of benefit sharing and the situation in which we find ourselves now, as you've heard from my colleague's analysis, the existing agreements that have been signed in defiance of Parliament cannot stand. They are unimaginative rehashing of the status quo that doesn't fix the problems and is biased in favour of the private interests rather than the public interests. This is a band-aid which is really intended to maintain the status quo, and it will not fix the problems which we've seen with the functioning of the system. It doesn't deal with benefit sharing except to provide that essentially the state is going to be sharing the benefits that flow from the animals of the Kruger National Park with the wealthy owners of the adjacent reserves. But it doesn't address benefit sharing in the sense that the chairman was indicating with the communities. And so in our view, there must be a new process. There must be an inclusive process set out by Parliament, and new agreements must be concluded which replace these ones which appear to have been hastily signed in an attempt to outflank Parliament. But in the longer term, the important thing to appreciate is that we do need new legislation which addresses the fundamental problems, which addresses the root cause of all these issues that we wrestle with, whether it's trophy hunting, benefit sharing, lion bone, farming lions for lion bones, etc. They all have the same root. And ladies and gentlemen and members of this Honourable House, I ask you to consider and put on your agenda that you should look into and in the long term move to preparing new legislation which moves with the global trend which one has seen around the world in terms of changing legislation so we recognize the scientific reality that we humans are integral members of the community of life on which we are absolutely dependent, and our fundamental duty is to protect Earth, to protect that golden goose, so that there will be golden eggs for every generation in the future. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you very much, Mr. Cullinan. Let's move. Thank you for your presentation. You have exceeded your time allocation by 5 minutes. I didn't want to be rude and cut you off, but you took a little bit more than allocated. Can we get the last before the responses? The DG has indicated that she will be leaving at 11. I would have preferred that you remain when we deal with the letter from the minister. But if you are pressed, it's fine. You are excused. Mr. W. Jackerman, chairperson of APRN. How do I pronounce that?
Honourable Chair, Honourable Parliament members, guests. My name is Wayne Jackerman and I'm the chairman of the APNR. We'll be discussing benefit sharing this morning. I have prepared a presentation. Unfortunately, the screen's not working, but it's no problem. I'll go through it, yeah? The Associated Private Nature Reserves, for those of you that don't know, are represented by Timbavati, Baluli, Kleseri, Thornybush and Umbabat. Thornybush being the smallest property and they don't hunt. This land is owned by the communities and by private landowners. The Associated Private Nature Reserve, we basically cooperate with communities, the environment and ecological as part of the open system. Conservation management using a sustainable social approach. Part of our agenda is always research, security, offtakes, and governance. APNR objectives, we cooperate with many reputable establishments. We protect land and biodiversity. We contribute to the economy in the area. Communities are all supported. Cultural and diversity is respected. We believe in a cooperative and mutual understanding agreement with our neighboring communities, with the guests and members that visit the reserve. We contribute and cooperate with government, and we strive to maintain these relationships. The five reserves make up over 200,000 hectares of land. Due to marginal rainfall and diseases like foot and mouth disease, these areas are considered marginal land use areas. If you look at 6 decades ago and you take the Bululi as an example, Bululi was basically a goat track. So all that could be farmed within those areas in those years was goats. If you look at the Timbabati and Mbabat, that sort of area, and Kliseri, they were old cattle farms where cattle farmers basically could not farm anymore due to the marginal land use. Local and international guests visit the APNR reserves to experience South Africa's wildlife at its best. The five reserves offer nearly 2,000 beds. 70,000 tourists visit this area annually. On average, a tourist spends 3.2 nights per visit. This allows for 224,000 beds to be filled. 68% of the guests visiting the APNR reserves also spend an average of 3.5 nights in the Kruger National Park. Five APNR reserves, we employ roughly 3,325 people. This could actually even be more now. And over 75% of these employees come from local communities. We have some fine upliftment programs where employees are trained. We have an example of a general worker that requested to become a tracker. He then advanced to qualify as a level 3 guide, and today he's a lodge manager in the reserve. Benefit sharing from the APNR partnership, we cooperate with the Kruger National Park, Greater Limpopo Transfrontier Park, the Kruger Two Canyon Biosphere, the South African Wildlife College, which is one of our partners. They educate, they do training and skills development. We also have the Rural Initiatives for Sustainable Environment, for those of you that don't know, RISE. Greater Kruger Environmental Protection Foundation, that's basically the umbrella for intelligence and coordinating of individual security commitments across Kruger, Mozambique, and obviously into the private nature reserves. Benefit sharing socially, we have many, many forms of that, but if we look at some of the bigger ones, it's obviously the Timbabati Foundation, the Lodge Foundations, and then the Global Reach and Communities as ambassadors. We also have EcoChild. All these are available on the website if you want to look that up. The APNR reserves are very aware of their socio-economic responsibilities. The reserves take pride in what they contribute to corporate social investment and community beneficiation. There's been over 100 boreholes sunk in and around the APNR reserves. We started about 12 years ago where we realized that children were walking up to 13 kilometers to school getting to school, having no water, and then having to walk all the way back home again. So we've drilled over 100 boreholes, and that is for children and various old age homes in the area. The netted gardens, that reaches to 13,700 students, where students are fed on a daily basis at school, and the netted garden process was also reached out to two old age homes. As you're well aware, in South Africa, it became a known, I think it was last year in about October, November, that government was quite worried about sanitation at schools throughout the whole of the country. Well, this is something that the APNR reserves picked up, as I say, probably about 8 years ago. We've increased, built new toilets and wash hand basins for the students. This project has covered over 100 students thus far, and it's an ongoing project. And it's also where boys and girls' toilets are separated. It was never like that before. Rainwater harvesting projects, that's been rolled out to 4,500 students that benefit from that, a total of 28 schools all in all. The APNR also offers bursaries. There are 9 bursaries that are offered to students that qualify to go to university. Teacher training bursaries, there's 10. Infrastructure, there's 15. And then environmental education, 12. Various other partnerships with regards to bursaries are also available. In 2019, the APNR reserves are going to be training and sponsoring 5 new small business programs, which will be concentrating on waste removal and waste processing, bush clearing and road maintenance. One can always go and look up these other programs like Kit to Kit, Supportive School, Eco Villages, Eco Classrooms, Library Establishments and Classroom Revamps. In the last 10 years, Kit to Kit has provided uniforms and stationery to nearly 5,000 students in and around our areas of the APNR. Santa Shoebox was reached to 9,800 students. Benefit sharing with regards to security. All the APNR reserves contribute to GKEP. The aim is to address the poaching epidemic, which is a threat to the biodiversity of the region, and the sustainability of sustainable eco-activity that the conservation tourist industries have created, together with the related employment opportunities for neighbouring communities. The APNR reserves contribute to the local community at this stage between 6.5 and 8.5 million rand annually. We spend 37.5 million rand on security. Obviously, we would like to try and reduce that at some stage and spend that money on other initiatives, but as you all know, poaching in our area is a big problem for us at the moment. So the total cost to all the reserves last year was 58% spent on security, and this coming year I think it's going to be 60%. APNR reserves are funded by tourism levies, landowner levy and membership, control gate income, and hunting. We had somebody present yesterday who said that the reserves generate 60% of the revenue from hunting. That might have been a couple of years ago, but it's not like that anymore. Our hunting income is now 25% of our total income. Benefit sharing with regards to environmental. Obviously, the APNR ecological monitoring, which is one of the most successful monitoring that we have in South Africa. We've got the Southern Ground Warm Bore Project, which I urge you all to go and read up about. It's a phenomenal project. We have the IPNR elephant monitoring, which is with Save the Elephants, the EWT and the vulture research projects, and over the last couple of years, we've increased our leopard and lion census projects. All of those research projects basically cost the IPNR reserves about 3.5 million rand. So we take 3.5 million rand of our money and we put it into research projects as we are well aware this needs to take place. We were very much part of the negotiations with the signing of the new cooperative agreement. We spent 4 years with various of our partners building the agreement, putting it together and basically getting it to where it was. And the signing, as we know, took place on the 5th of December. I personally believe it's a great step forward. I heard some questions that were questioned yesterday. But from my side, I think the most important thing about this agreement, it's a comprehensive agreement, and it's going to allow all of us to be audited. Every single member of that agreement will be audited, and I think that's what's vitally important. If somebody's out of line, there will be means and ways of disciplining. But this agreement, I believe, is a fantastic agreement. I think it's been put together well. It's comprehensive, and the big part that I enjoy about it is that we can be audited and monitor ourselves and make sure we're doing everything correctly. The APNR has been operating and practicing hunting and photographic safaris sustainably in a transparent, open system. I know maybe a couple of years ago things weren't as transparent as what we are today. If you want to know anything about our hunting, it's all on our website, and we are always open to interact with that. We've been doing it now successfully for 30 years. There's strict protocols in place, and I think one of the most important parts of it is that only approved outfitters will hunt in our reserve. Part of my presentation, you'll see various thank you letters, your Honourable Chair, and you'll see more information with regards to eco-children and all the other socio-economic fundraisers we have in the area. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much for the presentation. Let's get back to SANParks to then respond to the issues that have been raised, but maybe start with the letter that we have received from the minister. CEO and Chair.
Thank you, Chair. Following the discussion yesterday and as instructed by yourself, there was an interaction between ourselves with DEER, including with the Minister and the DG, and I wonder if the DDG, I think from the side of the Department and the Ministry, the DDG is in a position to respond. I think that from the side of SANParks, we spent quite a lot of time yesterday considering from our side where the errors and omissions may have occurred and what we should be doing about them, including how at this stage we can address the issue of parliamentary involvement and participation in the process of giving substance to the agreement, but also looking at administratively and in terms of liaison, how we could much strengthen our interaction with Parliament so that the kind of events that have taken place from our side don't take place again. So we do have a presentation that the CEO would be ready to make, and I think hopefully would address a number of the concerns, but also ensure that going forward that there is a seamless communication process between Sandparks and Parliament. And I think it also contains a set of practical proposals around ways forward that would also remedy the issues that arose yesterday. Thank you.
Yes, thank you very much, Chairperson, honourable members, and guest present. Once again, we want to thank Parliament for giving us a chance yesterday to go and consult, and we come back to attempt to respond to some of the issues raised by Parliament. And also, Chairperson, we try to go further to unpack certain things in this slide. I'll start talking to slide one, which is number two. The concept document for the agreement and several addenda were sent in November on the 12th to Parliament. It was, again, sincere understanding that the Portfolio Committee had received this document and that Sandparks will receive an invitation from the committee to discuss the concept. Again, we want to sincerely apologize for the misunderstanding on our part. It was certainly not our intention to undermine Parliament. We are committed to good governance and to due process, and we respect the role of Parliament in support of the mandate of Sandparks. Sandparks, by way of response, will ensure better coordination and liaison with Parliament officials and DIA in this regard. To address the communication gaps between Sandparks, Parliament, we will assign the function of a parliamentary liaison official to dedicate to the liaison with Parliament so that things are addressed properly. From our side, we interact accordingly. With the board, we will take steps to ensure that portfolio committee decisions are fully implemented, that there is better communication. We come to the next slide. Again, given the question from the members, to talk to the agreement, clarify certain areas that were not articulated adequately. The agreement being discussed is the Greater Kruger Cooperative Agreement. The Beneficiation Scheme Agreement is a subset of this, the detailed framework for which still to be negotiated. In addition to this program, a parallel process is underway which implements the decision of the restitution process, because the land was restituted, and then there was an agreement for Sandparks with the Commission, with the department, to develop a beneficiation scheme for the people claiming the land. This work is being undertaken through an intergovernmental process with agreed timelines. Again, remember, that scheme on its own, we can come and present it to Parliament, because it's a scheme that is being also quantified, as I glanced on it yesterday in one slide. The purpose and structure of the agreement and its key elements are presented here. We would like further to host the committee in Kruger and in the areas that form part of the agreement for further consultation or engagement with the portfolio committee. We also commit to engage with stakeholders to include the issues emanating from the requested PC, portfolio committee engagement. Even some questions did come up in the recent presentation that can be clarified the argument can be even analyzed further by an independent person. In terms of the overall purpose of the argument establishes a uniform framework for the protection, management, and socio-economic beneficiation for all areas open to the Kruger National Park. What it is? There was a question, is it legally binding? Cooperative agreement based on the 2002 Great Limpopo National Park Treaty, providing an umbrella framework for collaboration specific to conservation areas open to KNP, with the possibilities of further inclusion of new conservation areas. What is not? It is not a renegotiation, honorable members, of existing agreements, such as those of Mchechane, Makuleke, the Tabarange, Makuya. There's many of those. This one is overall. We just touched, honorable members, on the structure of the agreement. I won't waste your time on that. I think it's a normal legal setup of a document with what a party is involved, what the preamble, paragraph, definition and interpretation, objectives, areas of cooperation. All of those are listed there. Even the issues of dispute resolution, termination, confidentiality, and other general provisions. Lastly, Chair, the key elements, which are five in the slide. Under each of those elements, if one reads the argument, there are objectives under each key, but we kept now here at high level. It does talk to issues of governance in terms of compliance with legislation and management plans, also declaration of these areas to be added to the protected areas estate. Around conservation issues, collaborating on joint issues like water resource management, animal population management, and fire management, because it seeks to manage systems. Because when you manage a system of national parks, you need to make sure that that system is intact for species to survive, whether it's plants, whether it's animals, to prevent pollution and also mitigate issues of climate change. There's also a component, honorable members, of socio-economic beneficiation. It looks at regional economic development issues, enterprise development issues, and also community social investment. Safety and security is also a threat in the area. Of course, it is addressed in terms of cooperating, issues of disaster and risk management, because flooding is an issue, drying of rivers is an issue, fire is an issue, and also fighting issues of wildlife crime. Those are security issues in terms of people residing in the area and for survival of ecosystems. On the land inclusion, it does talk about additions of further lands and partners to the protected areas, estate, and the open system. Chairperson, we tried, and all of members, we tried to keep it high level, but we will respond in detail. The colleagues are here. We'll leave it here for now, Chairperson. Thank you very much.
Sean, you want to come in?
Yes, Honorable Chairperson, honorable members. In the overall response presented by SANPARKS, we have also added a slide that emphasizes some few aspects that we felt are also important to highlight. That notwithstanding the fact that Honorable Chair, you've indicated the letter written by the Minister to the Chair of the Portfolio Committee in this regard. There are two or three issues here that we had committed to or have been directed by the Minister and the DG to pursue. One being that we have to work with SANPARKS in the preparation of what they refer to further engagements with the PC on these matters, including possible sessions that were originally envisaged, including the public hearings or any other public engagement, and that we respond or continue to address those outstanding matters that came from the colloquium that may have direct or indirect relevance to this particular issue. Part of it will be a matter that at some point, Honorable Chair, when we respond on the date of the briefing that has already been scheduled, we also need to talk about the high-level panel that will also advance some of the responses to the committee resolutions from that colloquium. The third issue is the reflection that keeps on coming on issues around TOPS regulations that the portfolio committee has raised. There were some few issues that were raised here associated with the legal aspects and regulations dealing with the, especially when it comes to the use of species, the issue of res nullis. There are other two reses called res publica, res communis. I think perhaps maybe with the legal team that presented here, Honorable Chair, if it's in order with yourselves and the committee, we can create a platform with our legal team and legal people to talk to these issues in detail. When it comes to common law, there are so many interpretations. The last time we asked some of the questions around this by the portfolio committee, we brought one of our legal experts with a number of cases, common law cases, in reference. But there are a number of interpretations. But you are right in saying that the premises of any law should come from the rationale of understanding what this would mean for the country, and then we can create space for that engagement. The other last one is the issue of process, Honorable Chair and Honorable Members, is to strengthen communication between the department, the ministry, especially dealing with the office that deals with parliamentary issues, and entities on matters before the PC, so that we have the same understanding of what is flowing in and what is, if there are gaps in the spaces, so that those things can be addressed to avoid misunderstandings on some of the critical matters. I think those are the issues. I did not, Honorable Chair, talk in detail to the content of the letter, which is in the Chair's position. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Maybe I must just read it, since colleagues don't have copies. We received it, this one late last night. It's not a long letter, it's a two-page letter. I'm going to read it through for the benefit of the members. From the Minister to the Chair of the Portfolio Committee on Environmental Affairs. A signing of agreement relating to the western boundary of Kruger National Park. I've met this afternoon with the chairperson of the board and the CEO of SANParks, together with officials from DEA, in order to discuss the issue that emerged in today's session of the portfolio committee relating to the signing of a framework agreement with communities and private sector stakeholders on the western boundary of the Kruger National Park. I have been informed that the portfolio committee is of the view that SANParks defied the committee by proceeding with the signing of the agreement with a number of stakeholders on the 5th of December 2018. I have been assured by SANParks that there was no intention to defy the portfolio committee by proceeding with this signing function, and that there was indeed a misunderstanding around this event. SANParks had been requested at the previous hearing of the portfolio committee to submit a concept note on the framework agreement for discussion by the portfolio committee. This was indeed done by a submission of both courier documents and further confirmation by email on the 12th of November 2018. The concept note provided the rationale, context, and recommendations for the portfolio committee to note the alignment to the principles of inclusivity, transformation, sustainable youth, economic growth, and the advancement of conservation objectives. Honorable Chairperson, it was brought to my attention that the signing of this agreement forms part of the Kruger National Park Management Plan and the Annual Performance Plan of SANParks for implementation in the 2018-19 financial year. I asked a number of questions that made me understand that there was no deliberate intention on the part of SANParks to defy the portfolio committee, and humbly request that the committee accept the assurances in this regard. I also appeal to the committee to consider setting a date for public hearings for the sole purpose of a briefing as originally envisaged. I would therefore recommend that an analysis be undertaken on the framework agreement to ascertain or ensure adherence to the spirit of good governance, transformation and beneficiation, and that the results of this review be brought to the portfolio committee in terms of the exercise of the portfolio committee's oversight function. I would also suggest that SANParks board work with the executive team to facilitate this process. I further invite the committee to visit the areas of the western boundary of the Kruger National Park in order to engage with communities and the private sector in gaining first-hand insights into the challenges faced in this area. In case there are further concerns or input from the honorable members during such a consultation process, the board and management of SANParks will ensure that amendments to the framework agreement are effected, trusting that this takes us forward in the spirit of service delivery to the people of the area. Yours sincerely, Minister N.P. Mukonyane, signed yesterday. So this was a letter that we received last night from the minister. Of course, I read the letter, and I've got some views about what is it could contain in the letter. Maybe let me just express my views on the letter before I hand over to the members. Now, I think the central thrust here that is sort of been communicated here is that there was a misunderstanding. I've been assured by SANParks that there was no intention to defy the portfolio committee by proceeding with the signing function, and that there was indeed a misunderstanding around this event. Now, I think once more, the minister has been misled. Once again. Because there was no misunderstanding. I don't know why we continue to say that there was a misunderstanding. I don't know if there was a misunderstanding when we spent 2 days attending the colloquium. SANParks at all material times was represented. There is a report of the colloquium which has been 80-seat last year early. And that report talks to what was communicated in the letter in September, that there must be a concept paper developed, sent to Parliament in October, and then the committee will hold public hearings to determine the way forward. I'm not sure whether that is a misunderstanding. So the colloquium report was there, which is very clear, which was 80 seats. The there was a public statement that was issued by the committee in September on the 12th, which is very clear about what needs to happen. That statement was issued after we met with St. Parks. And the management was there, everybody was there. I don't know where the misunderstanding is coming from. 6th of November, when we dealt with the quarterly reports, the executive of St. Park was there. I read yesterday the conclusion of the chairperson, move myself, chairing that meeting, that let's receive that draft, and then we're going to schedule a hearing in December. And I remember I did emphasize on that day that we mustn't move with this matter until we have been briefed properly. Then there was a BRRR report, which was discussed, annual report, which was 80 seat, which also remains a public document. And finally, on the morning of the signing, I had a telephone call with the chairperson and the CEO. And I said to them in clear terms, please don't proceed to that until we're briefed. And I even sent an SMS, which was acknowledged yesterday that it was received. So I don't know what misunderstanding comes from. Maybe I've got a different understanding of what is this misunderstanding. Because misunderstanding refers to a situation where you say something else and somebody thinks that you meant something that you did not mean. So that is a misunderstanding. But in this instance, this thing is in black and white. Public hearing were going to be held, a paper was supposed to be submitted, and so forth. Now, there is an argument that there was a documentation sent to the committee. Well, the committee secretary yesterday did acknowledge that those documentations were received. Although I did not receive it, but they were received here in Parliament. But the mere submission of the report was not what was intended. The issue was that the portfolio committee was going to be engaged. There was going to be a presentation of a concept document. And then there was going to be public hearings. Before anything else can be concluded. So by merely submitting a document does not mean that is the end of it. We were still going to schedule a committee meeting where the briefing was going to take place, and a date was going to be then determined when are we going to do the public hearings and what form, whether we call people here or whether we go to the affected communities. So, for me, it's it's really a failure to own up to something that has happened, and then you say it's a misunderstanding. How does it become a misunderstanding when you are told that don't do something and still proceed and do it? And we did say, and I hear the minister is saying there is a defiance of the same parts according to our view of the portfolio committee, not only of the portfolio committee. I did say the colloquium report is a resolution of the House. And it talks to this issue. You can go and look at it. The BRRR is a recommendation, it's a resolution of the House. Of the House of Parliament. So it's not just ourselves here as the committee, but the House. And I must say all parties have owned up to that to that issue. So the proposal, I think they may not really address the problem, but we must regard this as water under the bridge. There was a misunderstanding signing and all of that. They don't address the fundamental issue that there is something that has been done in defiance of the instructions that have come from me, which for me is a principle. And the explanation that there was a misunderstanding, I've already dealt with that. There was never such a misunderstanding. It has been very clear from the beginning what our intentions was. So I think the minister was misled, and I would also plead with her to accept that on this one she has been misled, because I don't think she has been given all the facts around the situation, and therefore she might be intervening also with the limitations that she does not have all the information at her disposal at the time of writing this letter. So where I'm sitting, the major question is the status of that agreement. Before we even get into the content, one thing that I don't understand is why would an institution, when things have been brought to their attention that please don't do this, why was there such a hurry, first of all? Because there was no letter that came to us about this issue about APP, the management plan. Ordinarily, if there is something that was pressing, we would have received a letter from SANParks to say, can we please schedule a date so that we are able to brief you, because we have got a pressure that we may not be able to attain our APP targets because of this issue. This issue is part of our targets. We would have received that letter and treated it with the necessary agents. But in this instance, we never received anything. As I said yesterday, our last engagement was on the morning of the 5th, when we spoke to the chair and the CEO. We have not received anything, no feedback, nothing. That's why we were informed yesterday that the agreement was signed. We were not even aware that the agreement was signed, that signing ceremony proceeded. So I'm saying that for me are the issues. The argument about the APP, I think it's also one more convenient excuse to try and justify something that is utterly wrong from the beginning. And it must not be seen that we are in a way opposed to whatever agreement, because we don't know the contents of the agreement. What we are saying, or what I am saying, is that what we had requested was to be briefed on that, and that briefing never happened. We wanted to do the hearing. It never took place. The agreement has been signed. It's business as usual, and so forth. And I think somebody else must be taken to task about this thing. somebody must take responsibility for this, either the board or management. Because I don't think we should allow the situation where we say this thing here and people just act with impunity, defy us, knowingly. I mean, when you put your signature on the document, it's not that you don't know that you have been asked not to proceed. Yesterday it was the issue of the cost. People were there, the media was available. We thought that it's going to be fruitless and wasteful. And those things are no longer raised in the letter of the minister. What is raised now is about the APP, and that those things were in the APP and they were needed to make sure that the targets of the APP are they don't miss the target. Now we can't work like that. I'm going to hand over to the colleagues, because me, what I'm seeing here is impunity. Disregarding whatever that is existing, doing things because you think that you have got the power to do it. You have got the power. Who are they there in Parliament to tell us what to do? That we are not going to agree. That we are not going to take. For me, I'm clear. The minister was misled. She was not given all the relevant facts of this matter. She acted on the understanding that there was a misunderstanding. In fact, the letter from her talks about misunderstanding. And there was no such misunderstanding. So this is a big issue, I think, from where we are, and we will have to get some proposals from the members how are we going to deal with this thing. Now, this signing has even detracted us from what we said we are going to discuss, which was the hunting protocols. Because the first issue was the sharing of benefits with the community to make sure that everybody else benefits around that area. The second issue was the protocols about hunting as a result of the dropping of the fences. The animals are moving from Kruger to the other places. On this side, there is no hunting. On the other side, there is hunting. We did not even get into that because that was another issue that we raised that we wanted to deal with. Now we have been drawn into having to regularize something which was wrong. I don't think we should do that. I don't know what is the view of the members. I don't think that we must be forced into regularizing something that was wrong from the beginning. So the best thing is to start afresh, start the process properly, because we are not going to accept that we must then say this thing is business, it's all tied under the bridge. Maybe I should have spoken after the members, but that is just my initial reaction to the to the letter. And I think that we should not even seek to blame the minister, because the minister has got nothing to do with this. I don't think she was even involved in this decision to proceed with the site. Otherwise, she should have stated in the letter. So, okay. Looks like there's no wish to make inputs. Remember, we received the presentation and the two other presentations. about hunting. Okay, Honorable Kaden and Honorable Makwe.
Chair, I'm going to touch on the hunting, but you half intimated you didn't want to touch on it. But what I want to suggest, Chair, I always try and find a way forward because we seem to be at a stalemate here. But I think, this is my suggestion, is that we, well, I'm proposing that you'd get, that you organize a meeting with the Minister and Minister Hanekom, who was the acting minister at the time. And then you go up to whoever you want, whether it's the legal people or the chairman of the board, and try and find a way forward, because you're not going to find a way forward here today. I think I would suggest that you bring Minister Hanekom in, who was acting at the time. I think that would be a good start, because we've got a new minister who's not a fair with these things at all, let's be honest. The question to, that's a proposal. The question I have to, well, I don't know who's prepared to answer, but we've been informed that the beneficiation agreements are still to be concluded, and we were also told that this cooperative agreement is not a renegotiation of existing agreements. But there are approved hunting agreements, offtakes, with the APNR reserves from Mpumalanga Tourism and Parks Agency and Limpopo Economic Development. So I think we need to be told, are these new or are these existing, and whether they were approved by the sand parks. The other one, I think, is an interesting question. I don't expect an exact answer now, but there is obviously benefits to the Kruger Park on security and fencing costs from the APNR, and I would just like if someone has put a figure to that. Has this ever been calculated? Because fencing is an enormous cost, security is a huge issue, and we've seen the figures here, 60% of the total costs. I think we need to know that. Thanks, that's my contribution.
Thank you. Honorable Peden. Honorable Makubela.
Chairperson, thanks a lot, and good morning to everybody in the house. I'm under understanding, Chair, that my telephone must be out of here, meaning that we have got some restriction in terms of time. We may not go into a lot of other questions that perhaps was going to afford other presenters to further clarify their own issues. But I take it that if we need to do so, we'll find a way of getting them to clarify issues in instances where we may not be answered. I just have got about 4 points to make, Chair. One, just to let the administration and the board of Sandparks and the department to understand that often Parliament is blamed for us as a country administering or conducting poor policies and legislation. And it is our role as Parliament just to ensure that the kind of policies that we are engaging upon have gone through thorough public participation with a view to ensuring that we've got quality policies and legislation. It is not necessarily our task to run department. We are not in any way tasked with implementing what happens in departments, but we oversee what happens in your departments and your entities. We are sitting here not confused in terms of what needed to happen or needs to happen from time to time. But in a situation where you find that there's an established understanding, a recommendation or a proposal in terms of procedures, what needs to happen, we expect that once Parliament has resolved on a matter and there's some position which constitute a legal standing, we expect the department to follow suit. Without there being any confusion in terms of who runs the department, whether it is us or not. That's where the angle which the chairperson takes of defiance comes from. So I thought I needed to clear that particular part. But my third point, Chair, is that we are still, in as much as I hear, Chair, what you're saying, but I think we must still insist on a comprehensive presentation by some parks on the framework and the content thereof as to what has been signed. But that, of course, may be constituting some legal basis for those who have signed together with some parks, as well as the full presentation of the beneficiation schemes of the claimants and that which is intended for the people staying or communities bordering Kruger National Park, because I take it those are not the same people. The claimants and the communities that are bordering Kruger National Park and the stakeholders who stand to benefit from what happens in Kruger National Park will be different communities of individuals. And the third point being what the Chair as well raised, that we do need to understand who exactly does the collapsing of defenses benefit. One of the people who presented here said that they are of the view that the benefit are not mutual between Kruger National Park and the private owners, but there's a singular benefit from private owners and so on. We may want a situation where we are clarified as to whom exactly is this advantageous or beneficial, so that we get to understand that. The last point, Chair, I want to attend to what we do now that we are in this situation of one, what we need to see happening in terms of the administrative things that we still need to do before our term ends. Because I don't think we need to leave some of these things to the sixth parliament. They may not know or understand where this thing is coming from. We may need to conclude it ourselves, Chair, to try and get it within our own program, all these things, so that it's concluded. Otherwise, it may mean that the issues may be forfeited, although there may be legacy reports that will be done. But I want to get to the issue of the defiance. I take it whether the letter from the minister misses the point or not, or the minister was misled, or whichever way we interpret it. I take it the matter is now at the level of the minister, because she has written to us through you. Now what needs to happen is that the letter must be responded to, clarifying how we think ourselves of the situation. Whether that letter appropriately or accurately responds to what we, how the situation is exactly is, or what we think are the areas
of misconception around the letter, because now the matter is at 11. And then, based on how she responds to that letter, and at the time when this today input of this hearing, by the time we shall be adopting this particular report, Chair, this matter should serve once more at our level. We will have received the response from the minister, wherein there's need for interaction, be it telephonically or otherwise. That will have happened, not necessarily with many other people, but us responding to the letter as written by the minister, responding exactly to that letter, and receiving feedback from that. We can then finalize what needs to happen in terms of either sanction or anything, in terms of our own understanding of the matter of the defiance as we think of it now. So I wanted to make that particular proposal so that we conclude this matter today without having gone into exactly what needs to happen. If Parliament has particular resolutions and they might not have been taken, we'll get deeper into that in terms of what legally that means, it means, and so on and so on. But we must, together with the responses from the minister after some interaction, conclude properly on it. Thanks.
Okay, thank you very much. I think that was very useful in terms of developing a way forward. But I'm going to ask that the questions raised by Honorable Peden, if there are responses to the questions, and then we'll get to the way forward.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, Honorable Members. I will request, with your permission, Chair and Members, that on those agreements, Glenn or Marina, Marissa, to respond to, and also I think the fencing, Secretary of Members, perhaps, is referred to the private sector.
Okay, Chair. As Marissa is the person responsible for commenting on all off-takes, I'm going to ask her to respond to that one and the communication thereof.
Thanks, Chair, Honourable Members. So just to make sure the question, it was asked then, the question specifically around the hunting protocol, Honourable Member Burden. I just want to clarify, was the cost question specifically about, if you could just rephrase the question.
Off-takes, it was about the off-takes, hunting.
Yeah. But did you
the
just
agreement, does this agreement regularize what was happening, or is there a new arrangement now regarding the off-takes?
So basically what the agreement is, it's a new agreement going forward in order to regularize all aspects around the management plan. I think the question was also asked about what are the legal aspects and what is the real teeth around the agreement. So the entire issue around the protocol, and the hunting protocol still needs to be reviewed through the agreement, and that will become then the tool implemented in the management plans. So section 43-41 of the management plans indicate that those protocols need to be developed and put in the management plans, that the MEC and the minister could then respond to the compliance issues. So in terms of the current protocols, there's an existing hunting protocol that has been reviewed internal by the APNR and also by other hunting parties open to the Kruger National Park, that still need to be formally reviewed through a process and adopted through the cooperative agreement, which makes provision for that process.
Finally, Honourable Pere.
Now, the agreements come from the way I understand it, comes from MTPA and Limpopo. So, I mean, I just, what the are these approved before they approve? I mean, do they? How do you talk to each other?
Thanks, Honourable Pere. So, the process basically is that the final management or regulatory authorities are MTPA and the debt from Mpumalanga and Limpopo province. The recommendations go through a scientific committee at the APNR and then also other entities that's open to the Kruger that do have animal offtakes. It then goes through the management authority, which is basically assigned and they need to comply with the norms and standards for a protected area. In the case of the APNR, there's a joint management committee that then basically gets approved through the management structures. The request is then put forward to the MTPA and the DET. MTPA and the DET is basically part of the committees of what they call a pre-offtake approval process, where scientific information is made available. They also need to make available post-offtake reports, which is the financial reports, any demographic reports. So the MTPA is basically and the DET part of every process of finalising the approval processes, part of the processes which present to the EXCO structures or the management authorities in the case of the APNR, then the commence by sandbox open entities being requested, the final approval then gets scrutinised by MTPA and the DET, whereafter they then issue the permits or do not issue the permits. What is critical is it needs to be implemented in the management plan, otherwise there's non-compliance with the norms and standards and there needs to be annual auditing in accordance to the norms and standards.
Okay, I think let's ask that it must form part of the briefing in the next meeting, the hunting protocols or hunting in the Greater Kruger National Park, as we have originally proposed, because it was not here today. So we will get a briefing about what are these offtakes, what is the process of approving them, and under what circumstances is hunting supposed to be permitted in the reserves around Kruger National Park and so forth. So that will also form part of the briefing in the next, when we next interact. And I think we will then agree with Honorable Makubela that it must form part of the business of the committee before we rise. So we will have to prioritize that one. Honorable Makubela, I think was very helpful in how we should move forward in the manner in this matter, but we will schedule a briefing to do what we were supposed to have done in December, to get a briefing on the cooperation agreement. But for now, we'll call it a draft because as far as we are concerned here, it does not have a status of an agreement because we said it should not be signed. So we will have a briefing on the status of the draft agreement that will detail all the major elements of the agreement. How is the community benefiting, how is the role of all of the parties there to that agreement. And that briefing will also include hunting or hunting protocols. Secondly, the letter from the minister, we do acknowledge it, but for now we think that the minister was not given all the information pertaining to this matter. I think she was misled. So we will respond to that letter and indicate that unfortunately she was not given all the necessary information. because remember the minister is also new in the portfolio. She may not have an appreciation of where we come from, that this thing comes from as back as September until where we are now. So we'll respond to that letter to clarify the issue. But also the issue of sanction, which is something that we'll probably have to leave it to the next engagement. But it's quite clear that there must be consequences for this thing that has happened. And of course, in our interaction with the minister, we will then plead, if pleading is a proper word. I don't think we should plead. We must just indicate to the minister that there must be consequences for this defiance, clear defiance of Parliament. And the form of sanction that that has to take is something that the minister will indicate what form of sanction is appropriate in this instance. Otherwise, in the next meeting, if that has not been done, we will then recommend ourselves the type of sanction that has to be imposed, because there must be consequences for this one. I think we are done. I don't know whether it's something that I've left out. Is there anything I've left out? Honourable Penny?
Yeah, we've run out of time, but there was one question I asked about the benefits, the fencing and security costs. I don't know if there's an answer or...
Okay.
Honourable Chairperson, committee member, the fencing costs to the private reserves to the standards set by the authorities, in our case MTPA and the debt, amounts to 150,000 rand per kilometre. Security costs in the APNR, the current year, are 37 million. The APNR reserves spend on security costs, mostly aimed at anti-rhino poaching.
That 150,000 the maintenance cost.
That's basically upgrade costs. What we've basically done is, if you ever travel to Open Gate area and you're travelling along the Open Gate main road, if you get on your left-hand side, you'll see the Timbavati fence that was erected there. It's a fully automated fence with cameras and alarms every 150 metres. So if somebody breaches that fence, we know within 150 metres where the breach took place, so that our security can then obviously react. So all the fences in and around the APNR have been upgraded on a process system. A lot of them have been done, I think probably up to 65% of the fences are all that sort of standard at the moment. Obviously, I don't, you know, our statistics on our poaching, I just feel that's something I don't want to talk about here in the open. But, with all the upgrades of the fences and our security and all of that, our track record in securing our animals, especially our rhinos, have improved drastically in the last 4 years.
Are you fine, Honourable Pedder?
Yeah, I don't want to delay it. I'm just trying to. I can't imagine. I didn't hear how many kilometres of fence. What I'm trying to work out is the boundaries are being protected by the reserves and saving the park certain figure. How many kilometres? Do you have that figure?
Total. Well, what happens is obviously the fence between us and the Kruger Park is down. Okay, and that's, I'm not exactly sure on how many kilometres that is, because it goes up past us, it goes up to the Taba Ranch, all the way up to the Makuya, communities all the way basically up to the north, almost the Zimbabwe border. But the fences that's between Kruger Park and then some of these some of the community reserves, private reserves, those fences are down. But then if you had to look at us as an APNR and you had to look at our total fence that we look after, it must be in excess of 65 to 100 kilometers. I'm not exactly sure. I can't find out either.
Okay. I guess if there's more details that Honorable Padden would like to be furnished with, they can always ask. They will give you those details about security, maintenance, and so forth. Okay, we have come to the end of our two-day inquiry into the benefit sharing around the western boundary of the Kruger National Park. Of course, as I said this morning and even yesterday, that there were some things that we should have done better in terms of preparation. We would have liked to see the much more dominant voice coming out of the community, those who are supposed to benefit from this agreement. Unfortunately, yesterday there was just three community groups, but the major emphasis there was around the protection of the white lion, and not very, they didn't get into the details of how they see this dropping of the fences benefiting them as the community around the Greater Kruger National Park. So in future we'll plan better and make sure that we get as many community representatives as possible, those who are affected by this, so that we can also listen to their voices, listen to what they say, whether they are happy, whether they are not happy, what else would they want to see happening in those areas. So that is one part of our own critique on ourselves, that we didn't do properly. But otherwise, as always, we received the diversity of views about this particular matter. We do note that there is, of course, a very strong lobby against the hunting, against hunting the Greater Kruger National Park or the reserves around it, because it's not taking place in the Kruger National Park. The lobby was quite strong today, yesterday and today, and it raises issues that we may not resolve as part of concluding this, because some of them relate to policy issues, some of them relate to legislation, some of them relate to interpretation as to what is our understanding of the concept of sustainable use as it is embedded in the Constitution. So those are some of the policy questions that we may not be able to resolve today, but they require time. And I think we can continue to engage, as was proposed, that some of the issues require even legislative amendment, so that you can give effect to some of the perspectives that are coming through. But of course, the issue of the signing, that one was sufficiently attended to. As far as we are concerned, that event never took place. How it's corrected is a matter that, of course, is subject for ongoing engagement with both the minister, and when the SANPARK come back again. But I just want to send a message to both the management and the board of SANPARK. Please take us seriously. please take this parliament seriously. Don't give it a middle finger. Don't act in a way that suggests to us that you don't care about the directives that are coming from here. Because you are occupying public positions, you are occupying public office. You are the caretakers of the resources of the people of this country. You must always act in the best interest of the people. You must always act consistent with what, as public official, will be expected of you. And respect this institution that you are here to account. That is just my advice. Otherwise, thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. Members, I hope members you are ready with your outfit for tomorrow. Tomorrow is a big day, State of the Nation address by the President in the afternoon. I hope that you did manage to via the shops and get yourself something to wear. I'll be looking at Honorable Padden, what suit you'll be wearing. But otherwise, thank you very much for the meeting.